Yeah, I've been doing the usual sort of hodgepodge of a few kind of administrative stuff, then a good solid chunk of creative work through the day. And it's all gone well, and that makes me feel happy. And I've also had some other nice kind of textural elements in the day, and it feels like it's a good, gentle, well-rounded day.
Oh, I love those combined elements. What would be the creative work and the textural elements specifically?
So the creative work is I'm working on a novel.
Exciting.
Yes, it's my first fiction, although I do kind of think of my nonfiction as being a lot more linguistically flamboyant than a lot of nonfiction is. But I'm finding it very exciting to write something entirely free form like that, and also very terrifying. I don't tend to do a lot of sort of spreadsheeting and everything around it like some people do for writing a novel. So it really is usually a case of trying to fall into a slightly dreamlike trance for 3 or 4 hours and think about what's going to happen in that universe next and how it's going to happen. And I had a good go at that today, so that was good. Textural, it's been a lovely grey rain-pattered day here, followed by lots of sunshine. And I'm someone with an excess of physical energy in general. And if I don't do physical things in the morning, I can't actually function for the rest of the day. I get so dozy or so tense, one of the two, or usually tense, then dozy, that I have really learned I have to move in the morning. If I've ever tried to get up and sit down at a desk within an hour of waking up, even within 2 hours of waking up, the day just becomes disastrous for me. I can't concentrate. I feel awful. So I always figure out something that I'm going to do in the morning that's either useful or pleasurable that will burn off some of that physical steam. And today I just rode up the creek to go shopping at the cheap organic shop that's about a 20-minute ride away from me. But I got drenched doing it, and I also rode through one of the deepest puddles that I've ever experienced on that creek path. And even I rode through, and I was like, it's never so deep that it gets you past the pedals. But this time it was. And so it soaked my sneakers, and I was riding through like knee-deep water, because once you've committed, you can't really uncommit to riding through a puddle like that, because it could get worse if you get up and go back the other way. And that was just fun. You know, it was like, oh, look, I'm now like the soggy woman in the shop with sneakers shedding pools of water. And because it wasn't a freezing cold day, it wasn't unpleasant. It was just sort of a little textural upset to my morning that I hadn't been expecting, that I kind of enjoyed.
Yeah, I love that. I'm not quite sure. I'm guessing that it was Picasso that said that the end of childhood is when a puddle is no longer seen as an opportunity.
That sounds pretty Picasso, yeah. I get such a thrill out of when a water body breaks its banks. There's just something so thrilling about that shifting of a physical element out of its constrained space to start to claim some of your space. And so suddenly you have ducks swimming around on the path and so on, because they go, well, the river's on the path now as well. Of course we're going to go swim there. And it has a little surrealism to it that I really enjoy when water is surpassing its boundaries.
Yeah, it's a beautiful metaphor for how we can surpass ours. I love those elements in your day, and particularly to hear that you're working on fiction. And in The Art of Frugal Hedonism, you speak beautifully about how much of the aim is about leisure time and having that freedom to explore the experiences that you want to have. So I'm curious, what came first? Having the leisure time led you to the fiction, or has this been a driver behind building more time into your life?
I think as I've aged, as many people do, you become a little more sucked into the various practical aspects of life, and you find it harder and harder to justify things that are purposeless. And it's a trajectory that I'm very wary of, because I don't think it leads to happiness. And I don't think it leads to a better society necessarily, because once we all become so focused on the idea that productivity is what our lives are meant to be shaped around and things with a clear practical purpose, we lose a lot of that liminal space that makes us beautiful and interesting as brains and creatures. And having written two books that had, and I should say co-authored, not written solo, that had a very clear, useful function from the outset, I realized that I was reluctant to, I couldn't quite justify to myself spending the years that it takes to write a book on writing something that had no functional purpose as its endpoint. And of course, once I realized that I felt that way, I had to challenge that, because some of the greatest pleasure in my life has been reading fiction. And just because I can't put my finger on what the function of this piece of fiction will be when it is brought into existence for the people that read it, doesn't mean that it doesn't have a function, however hard that function might be to put into words. And I mean, if I ask myself the question, would I like a world where people just read a lot more stories and did a lot less work? The answer is yes, of course. So I kind of pushed myself to jump over both that reluctance and the fear to start writing a piece of fiction. It has lined up very well with the year of COVID, in that I haven't been able to work because I've got some health issues that means that I can't wear a mask, and that some of the restrictions around COVID have meant that I haven't been able to work in my usual horticultural job. And so I've automatically had this extra amount of time. Throughout the year, I've also, or the last 6 months, I've also been working with my previous co-author, Adam Grubb, on a kid's edition of the Weed Forager's Handbook.
Oh, lovely.
And that's turned out to be the perfect complement to writing one of those terrifying projects, which I'm sure as a freelance person you probably know what I'm talking about, where you spend all of your mental energy and time working on this thing that there is a total chance will never be seen by anyone else, except for maybe the few friends that you shove it under the nose of. And so to have something that has a publisher already in place to work on at the same time as working on something that might never actually exist is very comforting.
Yeah, I think you need the thing that can buoy you so that you can kind of stretch a bit further and sort of not lose balance. I'm quite a fan of you know, mixing and matching freelancing, day jobs, passion projects, depending on what I need with that balance. I loved how with the art of frugal hedonism, it really is an art, because so much of it ties into, I guess, approaches that really work well for the creative process too, but it broadens that and really applies it to our lives. And one example that I'm just sort of reminded of is that idea of flow, and how frugal hedonism really is about problem solving and building that self-reliance. But also this idea you mentioned in the book about how the frugal hedonist doesn't expect perfection. And that's another one that is really important for embarking on these big projects.
Yeah, and I think a great one for that is that sense of being present, because you can't really be creative if you are never letting yourself be present in where you are or what you're doing. And I think, you know, because of the buzzwords of mindfulness and so on, everyone's pretty aware of this general thought concept at this point, but not many people are still applying it. That stopping and imbibing the atmosphere of a moment, and that doesn't mean only a pleasurable moment, of any moment that taps into the thing about accepting imperfection, is where the furnaces of your brain really fire up and start to get excited by the flavors of life, whether they be the crappy flavors or the fine flavors of pleasure or love or excitement. But to be creative, you need to care about flavor, because that's where story comes from and that's where contrast comes from. And I don't know, I had an interesting moment the other day where I sort of checked myself, because I had spent a bunch of the morning doing quite boring stuff, and then I'd had to catch several buses to go to an osteopath that I was going to. And I was having that slightly resentful feeling of, oh, why do there need to be so many days like this that are just on the way to having the good days? They're just the stuff you get through to have the good days, you know, or to have the good bits of life. And then as soon as I had the thought, I realized how absurd it was. Because if you're treating any imperfect parts of the day as stuff that's just to be waited out until you get to the good stuff, you're very prone to miss out on a whole lot of flavor. And so when I got to the osteopath, as I was lying there with my face in the face hole, with my cheek all, you know, stuck down to the vinyl of the work table, the massage table, and I could hear his receptionist, who works on this sort of 200-year-old computer in this tiny, tiny foyer thing, you know, it's a one-room practice, and you can hear the receptionist typing away all the time. And I was laying there listening to him, you know, tell me some slightly inane, slightly lovely things about the possum that had moved into his house and what they were trying to do about it, and crunching bits of my neck and listening to these keys making this incredibly musical clunking noise in the receptionist next to me, and my face stuck to the vinyl. And I found myself thinking, this is life right here, right now. I'm in the middle of it. And this is not something on the way to the good bits. This is life. And it was such a powerful check on that tendency to treat all the bits that we weren't planning on and wouldn't have designed into our life if we got to choose, as stuff just to be surfed through.
Mm-hmm.
And once I had that feeling in that moment, there was just this phenomenal, almost ecstasy in feeling so present in that this was me in the middle of living life right now. And it stuck with me as a sort of mental practice that took about a month after that to fade out. And, you know, it hasn't ever completely faded out, but it really stayed alive through every moment that I had after that, where I'd check if I was sitting with a relative or something who I hadn't particularly wanted to have to visit, for example, and listening to them tell me about their broken toaster or whatever it was, and feeling, on my feet are freezing cold and there's a funny smell in this house, isn't there? And all of these elements that were inviting me to be looking forward to this moment being over. But then finding that once I sank into it, there's always a beauty there. And I don't know if all creative people function this way, but I suspect that there's a very strong bent in this direction, in that I care more about narrative and about story than I do about goodness and happiness and contentment, because it's very hard for us to have lives full of goodness and happiness and contentment, but there's something that makes us feel okay about being alive with all of its messiness and ups and downs if we feel like there are stories there.
Mm.
And so tapping back into that both enhances your creativity and protects you psychologically in quite a powerful way.
Oh, Annie. Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. It's astonishingly beautiful what you just said. I'm currently deep in my book that I'm writing at the moment as well, and it's about how we have the power to create our days, and just what you've said there. It's exactly it. It's the inane that we can kind of shape and sink into. So that was beautiful. But it also reminded me of a concept I really loved, was that of relishing. And I love the tip of, you know, if you are going through something inane or something frustrating, to pretend that you're paying for the experience.
It really does work. That was one of those. They're all actually very genuine tips in the book, but that was one of those ones that felt extra fresh to me at the time because it was a little game that I played with myself as during the writing of the book. So it felt, you know, it felt almost like a new discovery for me as I was writing about it. Yeah, the tip is based around the idea that if you're in a situation that either you think you could be appreciating more or that maybe isn't even by any common descriptor something to be appreciated. So either you're just undervaluing something that's quite good or that, you know, to the external eye, you might say there's nothing there to be valued. And if you tell yourself, imagine that I've paid $10 to come have this experience, how would I be reacting to it then? And it is incredible how your attention switches into really treating that experience as something whose nuances, whose textures and flavors and implications, philosophical implications, neurological implications, sensory input on every level, how they all suddenly become more complex seeming and more interesting and more enjoyable because of that. You know, so I guess the point I'm making is that even in a really technically fairly unpleasant situation, that some interest and some presence can turn it into something that becomes quite a worthwhile ingredient in the course of a day rather than something that needs to be taken care of and moved on from so you can get back to your proper life.
Yes, yes.
Because the illusion of a proper life is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, we're just going to continue to chase the lack if we go for that.
Yeah.
But this ties in so nicely to another concept, which is recalibrating and how you can really do some interesting experiments to get that sensitive pleasure palette back. And one example was imagine going on a plane and almost being childlike or on the plane for the first time and just marveling at the fact that you're in the air flying and you're moving through the clouds. I just love that because I think we just hop on a plane and, you know, moan and complain, but it is marvelous. So what's this idea of recalibrating or what's some ideas for how people can do that?
So recalibrating, if people don't actually know what the word means, is that thing of shifting the parameters of what sort of demarcates pleasure for you or pain for you or something being interesting for you. And, you know, the most wonderful things about human beings and the most dangerous is that we're so adaptable. We're very flexible in our brains, in our physical, in our physiological responses to the world. And it's partly why we've been able to live in so many parts of the world and why we can adapt amazingly to psychological trauma and still keep functioning is we've got these just phenomenally plastic brains and bodies. But that also ties into the fact that when you live in a society that really supplies your needs to a hyperabundant level, food, for example, is a really clear and obvious example that food that is so rich in fatty and sweet and salty flavors is easily available to even people on really low incomes. We suffer because we get calibrated to such a high point, keeping the food example alive, of food that is really stimulating in terms of its calorific presence and the flavors that are there, that we then can't enjoy simpler things as much. And it takes some discipline, but the payoff is pretty incredible once you exercise that discipline enough times. If you just don't give yourself everything that's available all the time, whenever you want it, or whenever you can lay your hands on it, it retrains your brain and your senses to go back to that super enjoyment of much more simple things. And so you can get away with feeling like you just had a mango and that was the most luxurious food you can imagine eating, rather than we've moved into a situation in modern times where eating a mango probably feels like the healthy kind of martyrish option to lots of people in lots of cases, because the mango is what you eat when you're not eating chocolate ice cream. And I like to use the example of how Christmas has changed, because it's such a good little nugget of historical change, in that in the times when people used to do really hard physical work all the time, most people, and where animal protein and things like dried fruit and nuts were a luxury that it took a lot of effort to grow and store, and they had lots of calories in them, that to have a large amount of animal protein and cakes made out of fruits and nut, dried fruits and nuts on this festival event, those foods tasted just so opulent, and that was such a treat, and you would have been so excited about it. And especially when you've got a body that's doing lots of physical work and you're really craving those calories on a bodily level. And now you know the fruits and nuts are the healthy option when you're not having the Mars bar, because we've recalibrated so intensely to a different kind of eating experience. And you can recalibrate back the other direction with quite a bit of ease. And I find that one that the best ways to do it is not to say, I'm just going to exercise the discipline of changing how I eat, but to have a full extreme event, because it's more fun to say, right, for this whole week, I'm just going to eat the plainest kind of simple cooked from scratch peasant food, no desserts. And then when you do then get to go back and introduce something like a mango the next week, you'll just be like, wow, this is the bomb. This is as good as it gets. And you can do the same sort of thing with technology. I'm in the strange boat of being both blessed and cursed that because of the health issues that I've got, I can't use computers for any sustained amount of time at all because it gives me headaches. And so I can't use social media, so I've never fallen prey to this, to the temptation of excessive media use. But I know for lots of people it's a massive problem. We really underestimate the amount of digestion that we don't do as part of modern life.
Yeah. I guess what I really love about the art of frugal hedonism overall is that it's so much more about these experiments that we can do with our days rather than typical, you know, advice on money always sort of speaks to budgeting and setting up a spreadsheet or earning more. Whereas, yeah, the frugal hedonist, it can also be about the experimenting. And I'm wondering if after sort of publishing the book and all the reprints and people engaging with you, whether you think it is something that is accessible to most people.
I think that in terms of increasing people's daily pleasure, it's very accessible to most people. That cutting spending massively isn't available to most people. And that is a big part of the book, in that if you spend less, you don't have to work as much and you get more time to daydream and conduct strange experiments on yourself. If you're someone who's really entrenched in a like a deep and profound mortgage and has several children to support and jobs that you can't do without driving a long way, then a lot of the cutting back of spending that we talk about in the book isn't going to be possible for you. I have been surprised, that said, how much more possible it seems to be than I had anticipated from reader feedback. The number of people who've said that they've read the book and then have sat down with their partner, I think there's actually been two emails over time that have said, we stayed up all night and talked about how we could change our lives.
Wow.
Which blew me away. For some people, it feels worth it to them to restructure aspects of their lives and go, could we move to a smaller house? Could we move somewhere that's closer to where we work so we could just have one car? Holy cow, having one car would save us 30 grand a year. Think of how we could use that time, that working time, in a different way. And some people have actually had that response to reading the book, which is beautiful. I think the most common sort of in-between thing that I've heard people doing in response to reading the book is really questioning how much they rely on money to give them pleasure or relieve anguish. So that very common modern line that gets bandied about by advertisers in particular of, treat yourself, you deserve it, or you've earned it, which I think is one of the most dangerous lines in advertising, that says the solution to feeling rubbish or having a bad day is to buy something, because it's only having something indulgent that you've bought that will make that better. And a lot of people, no matter what their financial situation, find that questioning that really changes how they approach their concept of indulgence. Does indulgence have to mean adding something more? Can it be subtracting something?
Mm.
And subtracting something very often doesn't cost any money. Can it be just saying, you know, it could seem important to go to this class that's going to improve me, or to renovate the kitchen and disrupt all of our lives, but maybe it's not very important. Maybe I could just have that extra time and that extra money and spend a bit more time being daydreamy, or spend more time just getting a really good night's sleep, because I never get to sleep in and I always feel like I'm short of sleep, or spend a bit more time hanging out with my kids because I'm always feeling guilty that I don't do that. And I think that reframing of pleasure and relief being something that you get by spending money is something that almost everyone who's read the book and talked to me about it has found really useful. The challenging of spending on stuff that I mentioned too, it is a lot more in common with your average sort of how to save money book, but we do approach it a lot more from the deep psychological level of, do you really want this stuff? Like, how much happier is it going to make you? And there is, as we go through in the book, there's just amazing research that shows people making even really quite extravagant purchases, be they practical purchases or pleasure purchases, and their happiness levels in every kind of survey coming back to the same point within next to no time, and that it's only having experiences that increases your long-term happiness. And that's another thing that people in any situation seem to really take away from the book.
Yes, that was one of my favorite parts as well, is this, how you put it, as the getting feeling, and how that can come from learning or experiences or new experiences, not just consumption. In fact, it's, as you just pointed out, it's longer lasting when it's an experience.
Yeah, it really works. And it's, I think one of the huge problems with so many financial books is they don't acknowledge some really fundamental things about human nature and us loving that acquisitional feeling, you know, that dopamine release that comes from the seek instinct of you're finding the thing you want and you're discovering something and you're looking forward to the getting of that something. Mm. We love that getting feeling, but it doesn't have to come from getting something new. And we've been sold the message so well that there's a freshness to buying something new that is going to make life feel nicer and make us feel fresher and like a new version of ourselves and make us feel stimulated. And all of that comes across in the different layers of what's incorporated into the ads and is implied in a way that leaves us with the really strong feeling that buying something new will scratch that itch in that lovely way. But none of those ads acknowledge that you can equally well get that getting feeling from a bunch of other things. And learning new stuff is one of the easiest ways of doing that. That doesn't have to be, you know, learning technical information. It could be just learning how to play an instrument or learning how to say one phrase in another language that then you say to your partner every time that situation arises, and that you've just gotten something. You've gotten a new ingredient in your life where every time your partner makes that dumb remark about the refrigerator and the noise that it makes, you say this phrase to them in French that makes you both laugh because of what it says about what you think of them having made that observation yet again. And that is an acquisition. It's a place that pushes your brain into a slightly different shape, and it's a new element in your life. It could be getting something in terms of learning to poach an egg when you could never poach an egg before. You've only ever been able to fry eggs. And that becomes a knowledge, and the shape of that egg and the possible future poached eggs that you will eat made by your own hands, they are all something you have just gotten that you hold within your bosom that will provide that same getting feeling. So it can be, I mean, it can be really simple like that. Mm-hmm. Or it can be, as I mentioned before, I think we really do love stories. We're a very narrative loving kind of creature in general. And it could just be getting a good piece of gossip from someone.
Mm, yeah.
It's really underrated.
It is underrated, and there's so much to show that it really connects people. But I think just overall, I love that getting feeling that you've just described.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So a lot of this does take a major shift and a major rethinking of the message that we've been sold. And that can come with, I know in my own experience, especially when I started out as a freelancer and I could, you know, I was in charge of how much I earned in a way that you aren't, you know, in a determined salary, and how that number could shift depending on how much or little I worked was kind of daunting. I felt like I was cheating if I wasn't working all the time, even though that was enough money for me to survive on, you know, a frugal lifestyle. So I'm wondering, you mentioned in the book about how it can be daunting when you first start to kind of adopt this frugal hedonism, and how it's a practice and almost requires recovery time when you're first making the shift.
Yeah, well, I guess the recovery time acknowledgement in the book was more referring to if someone's making a really dramatic life change. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is very important in that kind of circumstance to, oh, I hate the word detox. I appear to be about to use it, to detox yourself from that obsession that we are taught is good, that being busy all the time is almost a moral good. There's a piety to that. And it is a relative, it really is a pretty modern obsession. And it's worth questioning on so many levels, not only because of the growth economy that it's generated, but also because it often seems to make people quite stressed and unhappy. And we probably wouldn't have a lot of history's great creative works that keep us all sane if people hadn't let themselves just get a bit bored sometimes and
exactly
be a bit more speculative and daydreamy sometimes. But yeah, I know that, I mean, I struggle with it too when, because, you know, you forge new neural pathways with whatever you're doing. And if you've been having to multitask and do heaps of things back to back throughout a day, feels really uncomfortable when your neural pathways are then trying to run just on one track or not be zigzagging back and forth all the time anymore. And you've got to give your actual brain some time to reshape to putting a bit more space around things. The Protestant work ethic is really intense, and the best way that I know to help myself question it is to look at history, because there's nothing more efficient at telling us that something isn't how it has to be than seeing that it's not how it's been for most of humans throughout most of history. Yeah, it's the best way to break down that assumption that whatever's happening is the only way it can happen. And it really wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that people saw work as an inherent good. Before then, people saw work as something you did to meet your requirements. And that is such a difficult concept for modern humans to wrap our heads around. But I think it's one that's really worth pushing through to think about and say, well, why do I want to be more productive? Is it just to get more money? And if the answer is yes, I want to get more money, then you might want to ask why you want more money. Do you have enough money? Could you need to have less money? do you want to be more productive because you think that society needs everyone to be productive, then there's a lot of stuff you can question about that in this era in particular, more than any other, I would say, in that we'd basically all be better off at this stage if most of us were producing very little and consuming very little and being a lot lazier.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the best frame for being lazier I've heard. So
yeah.
But I think what gets in our way, and you touch on it in the book as well, is it's actually our comparison to other people. So it's, for me, I've come to really embrace boredom and laziness and find those qualities actually my favorite parts of myself now.
That's lovely.
But for a while it was comparing myself to other people and what I was assuming or projecting onto them in terms of their output or what they were doing and how they can't possibly be lazy. So yeah, in terms of consumerism or even just our ideas of wealth, how much do you think that's shaped by comparison?
Massively, yeah. I mean, we entirely frame our sense of how well we're doing and whether what we're doing is enough or good enough in comparison to the society in which we're living and particularly the peer group in which we're moving. And that's both really burdensome but also kind of hilarious in that there's so many human lifestyles throughout time to choose from.
Mm.
And that if we throw our brains out broadly to encompass all of the possibilities of what it means to be human throughout history, through different societies, that as long as we feel like what we are doing in our own life has some beauty within that scope, then there's a lot of wiggle room in who you compare yourself to. You just have to keep reminding yourself that it doesn't just have to be your best friends, that you could compare yourself to an ancient Egyptian slave. You could compare yourself to the guy in LA in 1972 who spent his whole life sitting on a street corner and just talking to passers-by in a deck chair and drinking 4 litres of home brand lemonade a day. You know, both those people probably had some amazing experiences and amazing thoughts and amazing stories because of the lives that they were leading. And what they produced actually doesn't seem that important in retrospect. They were lives. They were human lives that had beauty and that had a story to them. And that's what we should try to be making our lives into, not something that competes effectively with the people that surround us.
Exactly.
And it's hard. I mean, it's one of those things that, I don't know if you've ever read Alain de Botton's Religion for Atheists, but he really hammers home the fact that religion does people a kindness, and I'm not religious at all, but I really appreciated this point, that religion does people a kindness by offering all these mechanisms to remind us of bigger truths and better forms of ourselves that we would like to be. And it repeats them again and again via art and via repeated readings of the religion's dominant text. And yeah, in a secular society, we're supposed to keep bringing ourselves back to this sense of our higher self just by discipline, by saying, no, you could be more like this. Oh, you shouldn't have these cheap thoughts about comparing yourself to other people. We're supposed to do it all for ourselves, which is really quite a big ask.
Yeah.
But the neat thing is that the more we ask ourselves those questions, the more regularly it becomes a practice and it becomes something that we just use to actually define ourselves and how we go about life.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose that's what being a frugal hedonist does as well, is it provides a frame, and it's a flexible frame. I love that there's this periodic abandonment that you speak about. It just gives this, it's an inbuilt way to acknowledge our human tendencies.
To excess, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm someone that I think I get quite morose if I don't have some degree of excess pretty regularly, but I have learnt very much to make that the excess of going, to hell with it. Tomorrow I'm going to get up at 5 a.m. while it's still dark and catch the train to the beach and jump in the freezing cold ocean and jump around and scream. And then I'm going to be back home by 10 a.m. and go back to doing the work I want to do in that day. But like, there has to be things that perforate the structures of sensibility that we place over our lives to keep them chugging along well.
Mm.
Or I think we start to get a bit blue in general.
Mm. Yeah, we need that outlet.
Yes.
I suppose to bring that back to a day or a routine, there's this sort of wonderful element of limiting the burden of choice through frugal hedonism. And I was wondering what kind of choices you make day to day, or what that looks like for you specifically in terms of your choices around work or spending, or I guess paint a picture of a routine of a frugal hedonist and how that can change, because obviously there's the periodic abandonment.
Yeah. I feel like I operate on maybe a sort of 90% type rule, maybe even more, 95, where my basic mode of living, where that would involve not eating food that I hadn't cooked myself, so, you know, not buying takeaway food or coffee or of any kind, not having a day where I didn't do some kind of aerobic exercise because it makes me feel much, much better if I do, and some kind of yoga type exercise to stretch things out a bit, even down to stuff like spending. Yeah, probably the ratio is about similar. Stuff like if I need to buy clothes, then 95% of the time I would expect to go source that from an op shop, but 5% of the time I might let myself go, nah, that's really going to be better if I get it somewhere new. I'm going to do that then. Something like a rain jacket, for example, where you want it to last for a long time, that might be the case where I'd go, no, I'm going to go get that new.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that does work really well, in that I don't give myself choice about any of those kind of things until I feel really desperate and clear that I want to do something differently. Like, no, I just feel so lazy and worn out today that I don't want to go for a run. I'm going to just be someone that does desk work or reads books or even has an afternoon nap. And I feel okay about doing that because I can tell that I really, really want that today. But the other 95% of the time, I don't let myself ask that question until it's really clear. And just getting rid of that choice is a real relief. It means that sort of grazing for other possibilities just doesn't exist for me, which is very nice and non-taxing, because you're not always having to discipline yourself to not spend money on certain things.
Mm.
Furniture, I would never really consider buying new furniture either. That either comes from the side of the road or from an op shop, and that means there's never that temptation to go shopping to spruce something up, or, you know, homewares. They're one of my least favorite categories of shops is homewares, because they seem to be full of almost entirely things that no one actually needs. So I would never even bother going into a homewares shop. These are things that I actually find it quite hard to comment on because they're so automatic to me at this point.
Mm.
But I see other people getting in that fog of distraction of sort of, would I like that? And I realize that it doesn't look fun and that I'm happy that I don't do that.
Yeah.
Technology, I suppose it's a bit, because I don't use social media at all, I've eradicated that decision making of, do I look at this now? Is this a discipline I have to exercise? Would this be useful? Do I need to weigh up if this is a good career move to keep up to date with this particular strand of conversation that's happening in my area? I just don't do it.
To me, it's just so exciting. But say someone's skirting around the edges and sees how they can apply it to their life, but is worried about what, say, friends will think if they no longer wish to spend money on eating out. Do you have any suggestions for how to win over friends or skeptical family members?
If your entire social circle, if that's really the way they socialize and so on, I would never suggest to anyone entirely trying to stop eating out or anything mm-hmm. like that. But you can do stuff like invite people around to all cook a lasagna together or something like that. And that is something that most people quite enjoy. And once you've done it once, they are more likely to suggest it themselves because they'll go, that was so fun when we did that. And if they don't, then the fact that that time that you invite them to do that still becomes a difference within their lives and your lives that has a bit of a bleed effect in general, I find.
Mm.
You can always sow those seeds of, let's just get some bread rolls and go to the park. It's such a nice afternoon, instead of let's go to that Thai place where we know we're all going to end up spending $60 for dinner each. Inviting people in on stuff is one of the strongest things you have on your side, but also being really clear about why you are making some of the changes that you're making and explaining that to people is really powerful, because what you say is very likely to tap into stuff that so many people you know are feeling. When you say, I just don't want to be stuck working this much forever just so I can keep having this lifestyle that involves X, X, and X. Most people will relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you say, I'm trying to walk and ride a bit more and leave the car at home except for when I really need it, maybe we should go for a bike ride up the Yarra this weekend or whatever it is, then for lots of people, both the explanation and the invitation will tap into something that they've felt like they would like to change in their lives anyway. And when lots of my friends started in our, say, late 20s, getting higher incomes and spending a lot more money, I did find it was quite hard for a spell, where people would just expect to go out incessantly and spend all the money they were earning. And as most of them have gotten older and started to see the problems that come from that, it's been just easier and easier and easier to have people be almost relieved seeming to say, let's not go to that bar. Come have a cup of tea with me instead, and we'll go for a big sit up on the hill and watch the sunset. Like, so many people are into the cheaper option if you sell it to them right.
Mm.
It's more appealing to most people you know probably than you think.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Annie, for sowing the seeds and making these suggestions. And also, I feel like you've helped pull us out of a collective rut of consumerism, which is no small task.
My God, if I could help to pull us out of the collective rut of consumerism, I'd lay down my hat and say my work here is done. That'd be marvelous.